It's an oldie but a goodie, and in politics, always a truism. Follow the money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday, May the 4th. Good to have you here. All right, so here we are. The GOP dust is settling, has settled, I suppose. Cruz and Kasich are out of the race, so we are down to one. One for our purposes today. Big question. Given the state of things, where is all the Republican money going to go? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Big donors, really, really big donors, who can write $10 million checks, they're not necessarily trying to buy access.
You don't have to give very much to get access.
Bert Johnson chairs the political science department at Middlebury.
Large donors tend to donate for ideological reasons.
Trump is not an ideological purist, and that makes large donors suspicious, says Johnson. And Trump's rhetoric has been a turnoff for some heavyweight donors. Here's Charles Koch speaking to ABC's This Week.
I don't know how we could support him.
I wouldn't be surprised if Koch was the tip of the iceberg on this.
Professor Johnson at Middlebury again there. So what's a mega donor to do? One option for the partisan donor is moving down ballot. Stan Collender is with MSL Group, a large public affairs firm.
Saving the House and Senate. Right now, it looks like Republicans will lose control of the Senate and lose maybe 10 or 15 seats in the House.
That is plenty to gin up the Republican money machine, says Anthony Corrado, professor of government at Colby College.
So we're still going to see lots of large donations.
Just not so much focusing on Trump directly.
Super PACs already have spent three times more than they did in 2012 to this point and raised four or five times more.
$75 million alone went to the anti-Trump effort, but the biggest super PACs haven't even started spending yet. So under no circumstances does Trump malaise mean there will be less money in this election.
I mean, it would not surprise me at all if we see $4 billion spent on the presidential race before it's all over.
Twice as much as last time. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Sabri mentioned Charles Koch. I had a nice long chat with him out in his office in Wichita about 4 or 5 months ago. He told me the same thing back then about the GOP field. You can find that interview on our website, marketplace.org. All right, moving on. There are, at the most fundamental level, two kinds of counting that matter in politics. One is counting the money, as Sabri was just reminding us. The other, and this list is in no particular order, I should say, is counting the votes. You might have noticed last night that Donald Trump was declared the winner of the Indiana Republican primary at just about exactly the nanosecond that the polls closed. So how'd they do that so fast? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more now on how races, presidential and otherwise, are called.
Official final election results can take weeks to be released by local and state governments. So instead, on election day, the Associated Press sends 5,000 stringers to county election centers across the country. David Scott is the AP's U.S. political editor.
We are literally tabulating public information, but it's the infrastructure to do that in real time on election night where, you know, we add a lot of value.
To make the call faster, the AP will also use exit polls and precinct samplings. Scott says the process is the same whether it's a primary in Indiana or the race for the White House.
Same data collection, same methodology.
And a substantial investment. But Scott says they're in the news business and election winners are big news.
Yeah, it matters to us that when you see something about a race being won, that there's that notation on there that the AP says they've called the race for that candidate.
The AP isn't the only news organization that calls races. In fact, it partners with the major TV networks in something called the National Election Pool to share resources on exit polling conducted by Edison Research. Joe Linsky is the executive vice president at Edison, which also does polling for Marketplace.
But the overall U.S. election exit polling is about 40% of our business.
Of course, having media call races can have its downside, says Stephen Farnsworth. He's a poli-sci professor at the University of Mary Washington.
Think back to the mess of Florida in 2000 when it was called for one candidate and for another, and then it was undecided.
He says those mistakes serve as a big cautionary tale. There's no advantage to making the call first if you're wrong. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's an old Wall Street adage that says, sell in May and go away. Take the summer off, avoid seasonal variations in stock prices. So far, the month is playing true to form. Lots of selling in equities today. Some buying, too, as there kind of has to be. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hulu, the streaming video service, made some news today. It said subscriptions are up 30% year over year and that it now has almost 12 million customers. And oh yeah, also that it is going after traditional cable television services. Hulu's going to offer what's being called in the trade a skinny bundle, live sports, some news, and what we still call TV for an as-yet-unannounced price, and no word on exactly which broadcast channels and cable networks might be part of it. But one can guess, can't one? Marketplace's Adrian Hill is here to help me out. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Guy.
Hulu makes this announcement at a big conference, a meeting of advertisers in New York. So give me the business proposition here, the business model.
Well, you got to consider who owns Hulu. So you got Disney, which has ABC, ESPN. It's got the Disney Channel. You've got 21st Century Fox as an owner. It's got Fox, Fox News, FX, Fox's sports channels. The new cable-style service is going to allow Disney and Fox and potentially other networks to reach folks who've never had cable and really to hedge against cord-cutting going forward, basically helping keep their cable channels relevant.
You left out, though, Comcast, right? Comcast owns a slice of Hulu. Comcast also provides cable services. Help me out with that one.
Comcast is really interesting, right? So it's in the business of providing these massive cable bundles that these skinny bundles are direct competitors to. But Comcast also owns NBC Universal, right? So it might have some of the same value propositions that these other networks do. We don't know yet if they're going to be part of the service. And Comcast provides broadband. And look, the long-term play here is even if all of us cut cable and just start watching television online, somebody's got to send us the internet. Somebody's got to let us do that. They'll just make their money there.
Who ought to be nervous in the industry?
You know, I think Netflix has a lot to think about today. Yeah. They're much bigger than Hulu, but Hulu is growing fast. Hulu's adding to its library quickly. There are also these other skinny bundle services out there. There's Sling, PlayStation View, that are going to have new competition in this space. You know, we got word today that YouTube is considering live TV. And look, if you're a cable TV provider or a network and you don't have a good plan for the digital future, it's time to get nervous.
Give me the ad proposition for this, because Hulu already has sort of a non-ad subscription service. They've got a whole bunch of different things. So break that down for me.
So Hulu made really clear today that ads are going to remain an important part of its business model. It announced a partnership that's going to allow more interactive ads, so I could click on an ad if I liked it, like I might do on my phone. It also announced...
Do you ever click on ads on your phone?
Continue.
Sorry, I just want to get that point in there.
It also announced a deal with Nielsen to track the number of people who are watching across all of Hulu's platforms. And perhaps most surprising to me as a dedicated ad-free television watcher, it turns out the company says a vast majority of subscribers pay to watch the service with ads. They don't pay up.
Really?
I know, right?
Consumers in this country amaze me every single day.
This is really interesting because there is this subset of the population that pays extra not to watch ads, and those are exactly the people these advertisers want.
Right. When do I get to buy this if I want to? Do we know?
2017.
All right.
So hold your horses.
I will do that. Adrian Hill for us from the Entertainment Desk. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Guy.
Today from the Marketplace Desk of You Learn Something New Every Single Day in This Job, riverboats. Yeah, the big paddle wheel jobs that go up and down the Mississippi River. They loom large in the national imagination, yes. Hello, Mark Twain. In reality, though, they haven't been much of an economic presence in this country since the 1800s. But as Tegan Wendland reports from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, if you're looking for something different to do on vacation, you could do worse than taking a leisurely tour of the Mississippi.
A week on one of the two major riverboat lines, American Queen Steamboat or American Cruise Lines, can cost $2,000 to $4,000, all inclusive. That's nearly twice the price of a Caribbean cruise. 78-year-old Holland Ware sits in a wicker chair outside his comfortable room on the first deck of the American Queen and sips a Diet Coke.
There's so many people here that have decided they don't need to leave that much to the grandchildren. Money means nothing to us.
And it is posh. The American Queen is the largest steamboat ever built. It has room for about 400 people on three decks. Spacious parlors hold cases of antiques. Porch swings hang in the shade outside. There's music and Broadway shows every night in a theater modeled after the one where Lincoln was shot. A Mark Twain impersonator is along for the entire trip. More and more retirees are indulging. About 55,000 passengers set sail on American rivers last year. Baton Rouge is one stop on the Queen's Southern Route, which runs from Memphis to New Orleans. And on a recent sunny weekend morning, Jeff and Ann Frazier stepped off the boat to check it out.
Hi.
Good morning.
Welcome to Baton Rouge.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you folks with us today.
Great to be
and
here.
And from where?
Thank you. Australia.
Down Under.
Sydney, Australia. Down Under, of course.
All right.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
I'm sure we will.
They were inspired by the 1950s hit movie Showboat, a romantic drama set on a riverboat. It's a slice of Americana that was worth traveling for.
You hear about it growing up even in Australia, that far away, so it's just a bit of a mystery, and New Orleans has always been an attraction.
He says part of the appeal is that it's a real steamboat. It has one of those giant red paddle wheels on the back, which is powered by a steam engine and pushes it through the water, though in truth, it only provides about half the power. Professor of Tourism at the University of New Orleans, Bridget Bordelon.
It seems to be a trend we're seeing everywhere in tourism. It's this thing about authenticity, trying something to maybe recapture an experience.
Authenticity or faux nostalgia. Either way, it sells tickets.
Riverboats are really the next big thing.
All the towns along the way sure hope so. They're trying to capture some of that money. Davis Rohrer is executive director of the Downtown Development District in Baton Rouge. He stands on 3rd Street facing the river and points to improvements underway to make the area more welcoming to visitors.
What we're doing is lining it with green. So I'm breaking up some concrete. I'm adding some seating areas. And it'll go all the way down to the river itself.
About 10,000 people will step off of riverboats and into the city this year. That number was zero just a few years ago. And more boats are coming next spring. So the city's investing $4 million to expand its dock so more than one ship can stop at a time. Back on the boat, a few retirees sip from sweating glasses in the hot southern sun. One takes out his hearing aid as the steam-powered organ, called a calliope, fires up. They leave the port, heading for the next Mississippi River town. In Baton Rouge, I'm Tegan Wendland for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think the price of this textbook ended up at something like $23 or $24 million.
How computer scientists make everyday life a little bit easier for free, too. Not $23 million, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 99 points today, 0.5%, 17,651. The NASDAQ down 37 points, 0.8%, 4725. The S&P 500 down 12 points, 0.6%, ended things at 2,051. Uncertainty was the watchword today. Biotech stocks took a hit. Gilead Sciences off 1.8%. Celgene Corporation shed 2.25%. Utilities, with their high dividends, attracted investors in search of a safe haven. Duke Energy buzzed up 1.5%. American Electric Power rose 1.3%. Chesapeake Energy off, though, 2.5%. Travel company Priceline plunged 7.5% today after warning profits would slow in the second quarter. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.77%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama went to Flint, Michigan today to get a firsthand look at the contaminated water crisis there. He did the obligatory politician photo op, drank from a glass of Flint water in front of him, and in the process reminding everybody that it is safe to drink as long as it's filtered. The White House is also promising to help with long-term cleanup and with rebuilding that city's water system, although the details aren't quite clear yet. There is no shortage of evidence, though, as to how costly this crisis will be in health and in child development, even in something as mundane as property values. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
As if Flint didn't already have enough problems, home prices there have fallen 21%, one-fifth, over the past year, according to real estate firm RealtyTrack. And that's almost certainly because of fear about the contaminated water crisis, says analyst Darren Bloomquist.
And it really stands out because that is counter to the trend we'd actually been seeing in the city of Flint over the last 3 years, where home prices have been rising. The market had been recovering.
Recovery now is even more of a long shot, based on evidence from other places that are dealing with man-made environmental hazards in their backyards. RealtyTrack has looked at real estate markets across the U.S. that are near Superfund sites or in high air and water pollution corridors.
In high-risk areas, home prices on average are actually still below what they were back before the housing crisis.
In areas that don't have those environmental risks, says Bloomquist, median home prices have rebounded, and then some. In Flint, it's going to take years to fix the lead-leaching pipes problem, so the slam to home values will probably take years to reverse as well. City property tax revenues may suffer too, though James Homan at Michigan's free market-oriented Mackinac Center for Public Policy doesn't think that'll starve Flint's schools of funding.
The state adds on top of your local base to ensure a mandatory per pupil amount to your school district. So any drop in that is going to be replaced by extra money from the state, largely from its sales tax.
Though it's far from clear at this point where any extra funding might come from over the next decade or more to help schools deal with the learning and behavior difficulties of kids who've been exposed to lead in Flint. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Water is the point of this next story as well, but sort of on a bigger scale. A new report out from the World Bank says water is where climate change is really going to get us. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Having trouble getting your uncle or former college roommate to understand how climate change would affect them? Well, instead of talking carbon in the atmosphere or starving polar bears, you might want to relate it to water.
Whether it's droughts, whether it's floods, whether it's storms and cyclones or sea level rise, most of the deleterious, the bad impacts occur through the water cycle.
Richard Damania is an economist at the World Bank and lead author of the study.
It's probably no exaggeration to say that much of climate change is about change in the water cycle or the hydrological cycle and its impacts.
In other words, how much more water evaporates into the warming atmosphere and where it comes down as rain. And those impacts, they could have severe economic repercussions, especially in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Some regions could lose as much as 6% of their GDP by 2050. Damania says potential losses can be reduced by improving water management. Getting there, though, requires significant political will. Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute, says even the U.S., which is undergoing an historic drought in the West, needs to learn how to conserve more.
The system is getting better, but climate change requires that we do more faster. Water utilities still haven't incorporated the idea of climate change into their planning and operations.
The study also states the risk of increased internal conflicts over water. Think Syria. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
I say algorithms, and you think how Netflix chooses the next recommendation it's going to show me, maybe, or how Waze navigates you around constantly changing traffic. Complex, in other words, arcane computer stuff, accessible only to highly trained scientists. Which would be wrong, or so Brian Christian says. In his new book, Algorithms to Live By, he makes the case that we could be using algorithms in our daily lives, that is, sans computer. Brian's good to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
Algorithms are all about, you say, minimizing the labor of thought, which I just love.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the implicit premises of the field of computer science that computing is bad, which sounds kind of funny when you put it that way. But the basic goal of any algorithm designer is to minimize the amount of labor on the part of the system, minimize the time spent computing. And so this, of course, is a principle that translates directly into human lives, right? So we want to make decisions without belaboring it, without overthinking it. And computer science gives us a way to do that.
Okay, so here comes the real-life example part of this interview.
Yes.
You talk about how to decide where to park as a
yes.
good example of algorithmic thinking. And let me run you, honest to Pete, a real-life example by you.
Yes.
I go to Costco every 2 weeks, like clockwork. I got four kids. They're growing boys. I got to feed them. Every single time I go, I just grab the first parking space I can because I have no desire to troll around the Costco parking lot, which is inevitably slammed. And every time I do that, and I usually have a couple of the kids with me, we park the car, we walk through the parking lot, and the kids will inevitably say, "Dad, you blew it. There's a spot right there, and it's closer."
Right, right.
Right?
This relates to a field, a subfield in computer science and mathematics that's called optimal stopping. And it translates directly to the experience of being in a parking lot. There's this real trade-off that's happening between the two risks, the risk of leaving something better unexplored and the risk of passing the best thing by. And there's this explicit threshold that you can get just by knowing how densely packed the lot is. Let's say, for example, 99% of the spots are filled. Then you should take anything starting 69 spots away from Costco.
So what I hear you saying, not to make it all about me, is that it's not worth trolling through the parking lot. You gotta use the facts at hand, which I guess is what algorithmic thinking is, and then decide.
That's right. And, you know, the other thing that I think is counterintuitive to people is that even following the optimal strategy does not necessarily guarantee that you're going to find the best space every single time, but it does guarantee you the best chance of doing so, and that's something that can give you some peace of mind.
Well, or my kids, anyway. Who knows?
Or your kids.
You have a good passage here about the financial crisis and the mortgage meltdown and how everybody sort of thought they were doing what they were supposed to, but it ended, as we all know, oh so very badly.
Yeah. What's often going on in a bubble is what's known in the field as an informational cascade. And the basic idea behind this is that if you're involved in a market, there's really two things. There is your private information, what you actually believe.
Yeah.
And then there's the public information, which is how you act. And if there's a gap between those things, then the system can go off the rails. So, for example, if I privately believe that the market is going to, you know, go flat or something.
Right.
But I nonetheless buy something. Someone from the outside can assume that I'm much more confident than I really am.
And that is really the difference between humans trying to think algorithmically versus computers actually doing it, because humans have emotions and computers in theory don't.
Well, there are some cautionary tales that come purely from the world of computer science, too. That one of the best examples is there was a textbook on Amazon called The Making of a Fly. It was a biology textbook. And there were two sellers that were both using algorithms to set the price. And they basically just got into this feedback loop where they kept adjusting the price back and forth relative to each other. Hmm. And before Amazon stepped in and did something, I think the price of this textbook ended up at something like $23 or $24 million for one copy of a used biology textbook. Yeah.
Talk to me for a minute about incomplete information. Humans have a tough time with it. Computers don't always have difficulty, right?
Well, I think a lot of people would be surprised to find that there are huge classes of problems that basically computers have just as hard of a time with it as we do. Huh. And in order to get answers, they have to turn to some of the same strategies that we do, which is making a guess, using randomness, using approximations, and just sort of trading off the cost of error versus the cost of delay in thinking longer about it.
It's a book called Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. Brian Christian is one of the co-authors with Tom Griffiths. Brian, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, there has been speculation here and elsewhere that we're in a tech bubble and that, as all bubbles do, it will eventually pop. Well, the Wall Street Journal got creative, went out to Silicon Valley and talked to a ping pong table salesman, ping pong tables being one of those icons often found in startups and tech companies. Turns out that when the NASDAQ hit its lows this past February, this guy sold the fewest ping pong tables he had sold in 2 years. Yahoo, he says, hasn't bought anything in a long while, which kind of follows its troubles. Intel, which just laid off 12,000 people, hasn't bought in more than a year. The ping pong table index, I think we call it. There you go. The Dow off 99 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ down 37 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 down 12 points, 0.6%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.